Your name is Kavita Krishnan,
yes.
And you are a feminist activist in India.
Yes.
And, well, before we start, you told me that you are not longer the member of the Indian Progressive Women's...
Communist Party and the yeah. India Progressive Women's Association, yes.
So could you just explain why you have worked there for about 30 years, I think?
Yes. So yeah, it was a very long association and close association, but I was a leader, like in the top committees of these organizations. But basically, you know, the differences happened over the response to the movement in Ukraine, but it was a larger issue. So to put it really briefly, the position of the party and the organization was that we will just be a little softer towards really tyrannical regimes that are perceived to be against America. So if Russia is invading Ukraine or China is oppressing Uyghurs, then we will give some statement that is sort of here and there, but we won't really have meaningful, practical, actionable solidarity. And we will also make some excuses for these regimes. And so that basically led to a situation where I couldn't continue, and well, they didn't want me to speak about these things publicly, and so it ended. But there was another aspect to it which was really important, which is that in India we are struggling against a Hindu supremacist fascist regime. So they were trying to insulate the struggle from all other struggles against fascisms, like against Putin's fascism or against other far-right fascisms in the world. So the reason was because they didn't want to really recognize the full character of these of a regime like Russia under Putin. So what I was trying to say was that Putin, the language he's speaking and his supporters like Dugin are speaking, is a fascism which is deliberately trying to reach out to countries like India, like Hindu supremacists in India, racists in America and Europe, as well as China, authoritarian China, to tell them that, the West has double standards. The West has been colonial and imperialist, all of which is true. And it has committed terrible crimes, all of which is true. But he's mentioning those things. These people mention these things to say the West has double standards, so there should be no standards at all. We should all be allowed to do exactly as we please, oppress whom we like, invade who we like, and deal with our minorities as we like, because we are civilizational states and so on. And this was something that my party was unwilling to recognize, the broader left was unwilling to recognize. The global left behaves as though the world is still as it was in 2001. And so it's as though there is no recognition of this. And one last thing, Dugin, he has visited India many times, and he specifically says that caste hierarchy as exists in India is something that is natural to the world, and we need it all over the world. So he specifically says we need a movement against, we need to overthrow anything that is, democracy, equality, anti-hierarchy. We have to overthrow all this, because these basically mean the beast, the antichrist, and Kali Yuga. So Kali Yuga is basically the destruction of the caste hierarchy. So this is something India should be paying attention to, all of us should. But unfortunately, there was so much resistance to really recognizing this, in part because, Russia has a socialist, they want to believe that Stalin was a good guy overall. They want to believe that the Soviet Union was overall not too bad. We can criticize a little bit here. Some mistakes were made. But the fact that this was an oppressive regime that colonized Ukraine and Belarus and Kazakhstan and so many other of the East European countries, including Poland, including Latvia, Estonia, all of that, that's something which, the communist left doesn't really want to reckon with. Yeah.
So what kind of organizations or structures do you see instead of the political way to be active? What kind of networking would you propose?
Well, I'm already part of like a lot of movements in India, the larger network of feminist movement as well as human rights movement and all of that. So especially against the regime we have now in India, so there is all kinds of attacks on liberties and democracy and minorities every day, against human rights defenders every day. So there's plenty to do. But in terms of what political structure, I really don't know, because it's just been 2 or 3 months now. So I'll have to think about that. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, but you are already well organized and
networked. Yeah, I have things.
Yes, yeah, so yeah. It should not be a problem to go on with your fight and struggle. Yeah, well, I also would like to ask you, what do you see as the particular challenges for the fight for the women's rights in India?
Yeah, that's really important to understand, because I think that in India, I was very active in an anti-rape protest in 2012, 2013. So the thing is, around that time, like in the media around the world, the impression was that India has a rape problem that is especially unique to India. So I would keep trying to say even then that, look, sexual violence is a problem everywhere. In India, what you've seen is one of a series of movements against it. That doesn't make, and I'm not saying that to defend India, not at all, but simply to say that India does have some forms of gender violence that are very specific to it, which we need to recognize. And that is the violence against women's autonomy and freedom. So I've written a book about that called Fearless Freedom, basically showing how in the name of keeping women safe, you know, the implication is safe from sexual violence, but safe from the stranger on the street. Basically, we are going to, you know, lock women in their homes or in their hostels. You know, if they are studying in college or university, then the, you know, hostel curfews. And if they're workers, then they must be, you know, in locked hostels and not be allowed to have mobile phones and all of this, even if they're working for multinationals, you know, if they're workers. So the reason is because the pretext is safety. Protection. But what is it protecting you from? Basically, the subtext there is, we are protecting you from your own freedom, because you will end up falling in love with someone from the wrong caste, the wrong community. So if you're Hindu, then with a Muslim, or someone from a caste that is lower than yours in the hierarchy, so-called lower, with some other gender, all of that. So the thing is that in India, among rape cases, 40% of cases that are filed as rape are not rape at all, because the girl or the woman is saying that she has a consensual relationship with her boyfriend or even husband, like she's married him. But her parents have gone and filed a case saying, you know, this man has abducted my daughter and he has raped her and all of that. And these cases are entertained by the police and they go to court. So that shows you that that is actually a violence against her autonomy. And under the current regime, that has become policy. So especially marriages between and love between Hindu woman and Muslim man, these are criminalized. There's an attempt to say these are love jihad. And to say they are love jihad, basically they say this woman has been brainwashed, she's been seduced by these terrorists, because they want to make Hindu women bear Muslim children. So, you know, all of this conspiracy, hateful conspiracy theories. This makes it, you know, very, very hostile atmosphere, because before Narendra Modi came to power in 2014, there was an upsurge of girls and women fighting back against these repression of autonomy. But now it's, you know, they're up against this government that isn't ashamed to say that we don't like your freedom. Also, it's a government that's very violent towards Muslim women, but it also claims to be rescuing Muslim women from Muslim men, you know, because So it does both those things. You know, quite recently, a Muslim woman who was raped in 2002, gang raped as part of an anti-Muslim hate crime massacre, when Narendra Modi was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat. Now, her assailants were convicted and they were serving a life sentence. So they were released, an early release, on the India's Independence Day, just in August, 15th August. Because the central government, Narendra Modi government, basically said that, you know, they wanted to make this big gesture to say that we are releasing these men. And so it's a slap in the face, basically, to say we don't consider Muslim women worthy of justice. Muslim women are not rapable. And therefore, a crime against a Muslim woman is something to be proud of, not to be ashamed about. And so these men are kind of rewarded. When they came out of prison, they were garlanded and they were given sweets and they were, you know, heroes welcome, basically. So this is the situation we find ourselves in India, not at all a good one. Yeah,
yeah, I think it's also the question of the socialization. We also, if you have in Europe, also if you have kids, if you have girls, and then you tell them you don't have to do this or this to be protected, it's the same thing, and it's not as bad as in other countries, of course, but I think it's in the mind, yeah? It's a question of...
It's in the mind, but also in India, the specific thing is basically the caste structure, which is very dominant, so it's of course a Hindu thing, caste, but it has leaked out into other communities. So this anxiety that your daughter, you know, caste is kept together by ensuring endogamy. So if, which means marriage within the caste. So if your daughter doesn't bother about caste and just marries who she likes or whatever, falls in love, doesn't marry, does what she likes, all those things mean that the caste system, you know, doesn't exist. The caste system would implode if women had freedom. So that, therefore, there's an immense anxiety across society, in all communities, about your daughter's freedom, you know, that you have to somehow prevent her from doing this. The problem is that now you have a government, you know, this is the larger social, you know, thing. But if a daughter marries, you know, it may be that a lot of parents are upset, unhappy, but they'll come around. Now they have these Hindu supremacist organizations coming and offering a door-to-door service saying, come, we'll help you file a case, we'll help you get your daughter back, then we'll help you beat her up, we'll help you drug her to try and force her to renounce her relationship or her marriage, and we'll help you, you know, get the man arrested, if not killed, you know, all of that. So it's a very... you know, it's a situation where the state itself now actively tries to enforce this as policy, which makes it far harder to fight, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you have any ideas how to overcome this system?
Well, you know, the slogan here of which the Iranian women have raised, Jinjian Azadi, it resonates a lot in India because... For one thing, the words are very similar. So, you know, Zan Zindagi Azadi is one of the ways in which it's said in Persian, and the Jinjian Azadi is more the Kurdish version. So the thing is, the words Zan Zindagi Azadi are all three words that anyone in North India would understand, you know, because these are words almost similar, almost the same in Hindi or in Urdu and all of that, many Indian languages. So the thing is that I think that that is what, you know, movements in India have tried to assert. So for instance, the remarkable movement led by Muslim women in India just before the lockdown, you know, 2019 to 2020, just before the lockdown, it happened for a year, where they basically were protesting the citizenship law that tries to strip Muslims of citizenship by various, you know, pretexts, pincer motion of two laws. I'll explain that later. But this movement was about, you know, dignity as human beings, inclusiveness of everybody, and so, you know, in making India's constitutional values come alive rather than just being on paper, something you can go and ask the court to respect. Rather, it was something everyone was owning up, you know. India's national anthem became a like a protest song on the streets and all of that. So it became a very remarkable movement. And unfortunately, that movement has faced a huge crackdown in the name of the lockdown and pandemic. There was violence against Muslims. And then those arrested were not the Hindu supremacist leaders who instigated the violence, but rather the protesters, including many women and Muslim women, as well as their supporters who were not Muslim. So but I still think that that spirit of Azadi, that spirit of freedom and asserting freedom, that is what's important. So in 2012-13 also, rather than just saying, oh, protect women or, you know, punish the rapists, we had raised the slogan then that we want you to protect our fearless freedom, Bekhauf Azadi, our fearless freedom. So I think that that's still the way ahead. And that's what we need to do. One small thing which I'll add, if there's time, is that in Iran, you know that women are being forced to wear the hijab and forced to wear the that cover themselves, and they are protesting by taking it off, right? In India, across like Hindus, Muslims, everywhere, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, every community, there is a, you know, culture, especially in rural India, of covering your face. Women are supposed to cover their heads. But the Hindu supremacists are singling out the hijab and saying that Muslims are uniquely anti-women, and so we won't allow Muslim girls to attend school unless they take off the hijab. Now, that's perverse in so many ways, because, you know, girls, you know, you're pitting them against their family. If they get an education, then tomorrow they may not want to wear this. But the point is that the hijab is also, you know, because it is a symbol of, you know, very visible Muslimness, like the skull cap that men wear. It's also a way that girls are protesting by saying that we are Muslim and we're not going to let you make us invisible. And when they do that, then you're saying, you know, you either study in a Muslim-only school or college and not with everyone. So it's become, and now they're saying, oh, look, the Iranian women are taking off their hijabs. So why are you people supporting the girls who want to wear it? And we said, it's really simple. It is about autonomy. You know, when women don't want to wear it, don't force them to wear it. Girls want to wear it or women want to wear it, don't force them not to wear it. The state can't come and, you know, impose these laws. And as feminists, you know, the point is context is everything. So what context someone is choosing to wear something in? You know, in France and all of that, these burqa bans and all, they're saying you can't wear a burkini even to the beach. Now, if I go to the beach, I'm a feminist. In theory, I'm all for, like, you know, absolutely wear what you like. But if you ask me, I will feel, you know, the way I'm brought up, I'm going to feel uncomfortable maybe wearing a bikini or something. I'll probably wear a swimsuit that kind of covers my, you know, my large parts of my body, just because I will then be able to be free and happy and comfortable, you know, having fun at the beach. But if you say, no, you're not allowed to, whatever notion of modesty you have, of course it may be patriarchal. Of course it may be my socialization. But I have a right to be comfortable, right? You can't tell me that I have to wear, you know, such and such, or else, you know, if I cover myself, then I can't go to the beach. You know, that's crazy. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time. Yeah, thanks
Pleasure
very much.
Pleasure talking to you.